Meet Reed L. Rosenthal, rancher, number one best-selling award-winning author, and unabashedly, unapologetically, on the right side of the outstanding issues of our generation. But don't try to fence him in. Sometimes his positions will surprise you, because Reed is definitely his own man with his own opinions. You might love him, you might hate him, but you won't be able to stop listening. Step over to the right side with Reed.
Howdy, listeners. This is Reed Lance Rosenthal on the right side, and today we have a special guest. His name is Anoop Desai. I hope I pronounced that correctly.
Yep, correctly.
Very good. And Anoop is one of the organizers of Occupy Wall Street back there in New York. He's also their press spokesman, and we're going to delve into a little bit about him, a little bit about the movement, and particularly what folks in the movement and Anoop think about kind of current events. You name it, from A to Z, because I think a lot of voice has been wasted on larger, distractive pictures with what's going on with this outfit, and I think they have a right, and I have a curiosity, and I'm sure you do too, to hear what they have to say on very specific matters which are affecting our everyday lives and which are on the news, hour in and hour out. So Anoop, I've been reading your bio, and boy, you've been a lot of places.
Mm-hmm.
South America, yeah. Egypt, the United States.
Not Egypt? No, it's Egypt in there, India.
And India? Yeah, actually there's a couple articles here that say you were in Egypt. But in any event, you're well-traveled. You're a professor, is that correct?
Yes, sir.
And I was a little confused. Are you at the City College of New York or the Borough College in Manhattan?
Okay, so it's the College of Staten Island and the Borough of Manhattan Community College, and they're all under the umbrella of the City University of New York.
Gotcha. And tell me what you've been teaching there.
So I've been teaching Introduction to Geography and Introduction to Philosophy.
Those are widely divergent subjects.
You would think so, but in truth, geography allows for a lot of creativity as well. There's an art to all this, in terms of determining how the land is affecting everyday culture.
Well, I'm a huge proponent of the energy of land, its use, and its protection. So mm-hmm. I understand exactly what you're saying. Let me ask you a question. How did you get involved in this whole thought process that is Occupy Wall Street? I mean, tell me kind of very briefly your history.
Okay, so it started September 17th, and at first I didn't think much of it. I mean, growing up, at least I'm 27 years old, our generation hasn't really protested much about anything. And I didn't really see much of an effect happening. So to tell you the truth, in the beginning, I was very skeptical. And then about 2 weeks later, I saw all the attention that I was getting in the media, and most of it being negative attention. When in reality, I saw this movement as an educational movement, the fact that people are talking about what's happening in the world, what's happening in our country, and me being an educator, I saw this as an opportunity to be able to have people's voices heard. Specifically after I went to the park and I realized the way the media was representing it and the way the people were that were actually there protesting, I felt as though I wanted to do my best to kind of shine a different light on.
I think some of the media has been very kind, don't you think?
Tell you the truth, I think yes, some has been kind, but the fact is it hasn't been very, I think, balanced. For what we're doing here, we're having a communication. Me and you, Reed, I think the media hasn't been doing its job with that or many other subjects.
Well, as we were talking before the interview, most media works in bites. I like much longer stretches because people get to express themselves, and they don't get clipped, if you know what I'm saying.
Mm-hmm. Definitely.
You're 27. So are you a full professor or are you an associate professor?
No, associate. I don't.
Yeah, because 27 is kind of young for getting tenure.
Mm-hmm, most definitely.
And it looks like to me, since you've taught, you taught in Mexico City too, didn't you?
Yes, I taught in Mexico City as well.
So with all the different places you've taught, it's been kind of tough to to grab tenure unless you started when you were about 2 years old. Anoop in diapers in front of the class. All right.
The youth helps, though, you know?
I'm sorry?
The youth helps, I guess, in a way.
Yes.
People pay attention to something.
You know, youth helps in a lot of respects. Some respects, it does not.
Yeah,
I noticed on your website you use the words the precepts of social entrepreneurship. Explain that to me. What is that?
Social entrepreneurship, it's a new movement that's been happening. I mean, obviously we know what entrepreneurship is, taking the innovative and creative and bringing something new to the business world. Well, the social entrepreneurship is adding a little bit to that in the fact of something that's benefiting humanity directly. And so these are movements that are happening, but they're happening much more in places like India, where there is so much poverty, and this combination needs to come into effect. And so we're getting a lot of innovative minds in India working on a lot of different projects, you know, and like environmental projects as well, biogas. Are you familiar with biogas?
I am.
Okay, yeah, so something like that that's directly benefiting the people in the community while also benefiting an organization that could profit off it as well.
And is your research in that area or your involvement in that area based on algae, or is it based on other
it
biofuels?
No, it wasn't based on algae. More biofuels, but I've been actually hearing a lot more about the algae, and that is something that I should do a lot more research on, to tell you the truth.
And I noticed that you have an environmental bent, you know, in what you've written and what you've said. So, you know, tell me what you think about the environmental movement in the United States. First of all, do you, and anytime you want to differentiate between what you personally think and what the Occupy Wall Street folks, you know, that you represent think, feel free, okay?
Okay, yeah, let me start by saying that. I'm by no means a direct spokesman or anything for Occupy Wall Street because we do have no leader or no direct demands as of yet. So everything that I am saying from just my heart and my beliefs.
Okay, but you were referred to us by our other contacts at Occupy Wall Street, and I'm looking at a number of articles here where you're called the press spokesman.
Well, one of the press spokesmen. I mean, it's just, what else are you going to call us, you know? the idea is I am telling you now, you know, like for the audience as well. But,
So tell me what you and Occupy Wall Street think of global warming.
What I think of global warming, I think it's something that should be paid attention to.
Mm-hmm.
I understand there's like a lot of science for it. There's some science against it. Some people, but the science against it is often saying that this is a natural cycle. And to me, regardless whether it's an artificial cycle or a natural cycle, it's something that we should pay attention to. You know, it's something that we should work on. It shouldn't be a political issue. You know, it's something that in reality should be an issue through society that we should discuss, you know, intelligently.
While we're on that subject, do you believe the United States should take steps to become energy independent?
Oh, most definitely. Of course.
And does that include fossil fuels or just alternatives?
In what sense do you mean does that include fossil fuels?
Well, fossil fuels would be natural gas, you know, oil.
No, are you saying that we should kind of separate ourselves from fossil fuels, or?
No, I'm not. I'm asking you. What's your opinion?
I believe we should do our best in some sense to separate ourselves from fossil fuels. I mean, now we need a longer time period to do that, but I believe as a country, we're one of the most innovative countries in the entire world, and we have the technology and ability to accomplish some of these facts. You know, it's just simple. Solar and wind are a lot cleaner, but it's something that we need to work on.
Yes, okay. we're not even close yet, are we?
Yeah, I mean, for our capabilities and our intelligence and for the level of sophistication of our technology, no, we're not even close.
Of course, that comes down to one of your pet peeves, which we may share, which is, corporate and government graft, corruption, greed, and payback using other people's money.
Mm-hmm.
Because when you throw, you know, 70 and 80% subsidies at alternative fuels like wind and solar, you are hardly allowing a market-based concept, which is going to work, emerge. Instead, you're kind of padding the wallets of fat cats who turn around and reimburse you with large campaign contributions filtered through many sources. Would you agree with that?
You said the subsidies were going to wind and solar?
Yes.
And they're not going to, but they're also going as well to the oil and natural gas and solar.
Well, actually, oil gets about a 14% subsidy. Wind gets a 101% subsidy, and solar gets a 64% subsidy. Unfortunately, wind and solar only work at point-specific power generations. In other words, a small windmill outside a ranch house or a home, or a solar collector, where the point of power generation transmits power just a short distance to the residents, works fine. But trying to build large wind farms or solar farms and transport the energy via power lines through pristine wilderness 1,000 miles away, and then charging the end user 23% more, is probably not a market-based solution. What do you think?
No, but it's a solution that we need to do in the beginning, just because for how long we've been using wind energy as compared to how long we've been using oil and gas energy. In the beginning, it's going to need a little bit more coddling and cradling and taking care of.
I notice on your website that you talk about a worldwide atmosphere, and I quote, that fosters peace, eradicates hunger, and fights poverty. Tell me a little bit about how, you know, just some bullet points. Tell me three ways that you would accomplish those goals.
First thing, I relate everything just to the home, communication, especially among family and friends in the community. I think oftentimes I think we're becoming very divisive in terms of our beliefs and how we're able to communicate and handle our beliefs. And I think one thing that we should most definitely do is at least discuss these issues in a humane way, you know, kind of like we're doing right now. Second step, what I would suggest is then actually doing work within the community. You know, so let's branch out a little bit further, you know, participate. What does our community need? Even in terms of, I was having a discussion in my class yesterday about, we're talking about diamond rings, you know, and in fact how people in Africa are working for a dollar a day. If they find a diamond, like slave wages, and oftentimes there's also blood diamonds as well that used to fuel these wars. And diamonds, I mean, the benefit of diamonds, engagement rings are mostly vanity. So now if we took all the hours that we spent buying something of just purely symbolic value and say we built, so you got some of these people to build a park, you know, or a swing set, something that gives back to the community, you know, think about the effect that would have so long, like just long lasting, you know, for the future children, a place for people to congregate and get together.
You mean like Michelle Obama buying $48,000 worth of diamonds in one shopping spree 2 weeks ago?
Yeah, I if that's the case, I totally disagree with that, and I think that sets a negative example.
Yeah, that's the case.
That's everybody.
Yeah, we agree
like
on
that's
that.
That's the celebrity culture, yeah.
I think the celebrity culture is perfectly said. Perfectly said.
It's the media that's promoting this celebrity culture, like that we must realize. Look, this is not intelligent, and this is not what's good for the people of this country.
Well, you're assuming that the media is intelligent. You know, I mean, that could be an oxymoron in many cases. Just out of curiosity,
yeah.
Do you know how much has been spent by the United States on supposedly trying to eliminate poverty since 1964, since Johnson's Great Society?
How much?
$12 trillion.
Okay, I'm not sure about those numbers. I'd have to look into
it. I'm positive about those numbers. You can feel free to Google it and look it up. In fact, you can go to the Congressional Budget Office. So
okay.
There's been $12 trillion spent. I know what my opinion is. How do you think it's worked?
Oh, I mean, look, it's where they're spending it that matters. And now I also have like a certain distrust as to what the government is spending it on. Because like we just talked about before, politically, it's money that's controlling politics. One out of every two members of Congress are millionaires, and then the other half are in the back pocket of millionaires. So now when they say they're spending money to fight poverty, maybe they're spending that money, some of those trillions of dollars, on vaccines for some children in Africa for malaria. Now, to me, that's just an entire waste of money, because the World Health Organization has said for every $1 you spend on sanitation, you save $9 in health care costs. So if our government just spent all that money on mosquito nettings and toilets, it would have a huge, it would have a lot further effect, and instead of spending $1 trillion, we could spend $3 billion. But the only problem is this, people don't make money off of those mosquito nettings and toilets. And so therefore, I feel as though it's, we're misguided in how we're spending our money.
Well, you know what?
Can I say my third point real quick?
Sure.
My third point before I said, so first talking at home in the family, and the second step doing work in the community. I believe the third step would be then now to actually travel outside our community internationally. And this way, I just believe in connections, and I believe in getting information unfiltered. And so my steps would be that. First do work at home, second do work in the community, and third, go do some work internationally. And that way we all have an understanding that we're all human beings and we have, like, these similar methodologies and experiences, you know, and just give each other a greater sense of caring.
You know, in a big picture sense, and by the way, I happen to agree with what you just said. I mean, you know, money is wasted, and it's spent for political means rather than for absolute benefit. And I think your example with the mosquito netting versus the vaccine is perfect. I mean, well said. Do you think government is your friend or your enemy?
It's neither. It's definitely not our, like, I don't believe it's our enemy, you know? I just believe it's maybe somebody in the neighborhood that does some nice things and some wrong things, and I'm not really sure exactly what its agenda might be currently. But the idea is that it's supposed to be there for good, you know? And it has done friendly things most definitely in the past, but it's also done a lot of, it's been an enemy to other people in other countries that may have not been deserving so.
Are you a proponent of large government or small government?
I'm a proponent of good government, and I'm not sure if within each branch of the particular government may be beneficial to have less people, may be beneficial to have more people in certain parts. You know, in that sense, I'm up to consensus for what the people of America want. You know, in discussion of that. The way it's working now, one thing I do know is we just need a change. You know, it's 9% of people are approve of Congress, which is absurd. If the number is only 9, we have a grave issue in this country.
Yeah, well, 31% approve of the president. That's equally absurd.
No, I agree. They're all, this isn't Republican or Democrat to me. The way I view this now is everybody's sleeping in the same bed together. You know, the idea is now that people have to realize, and what government and what media and what people want us to do are have Republicans, Democrats fight each other, because that's a battle that's easier to win rather than the battle against big money and big government.
Well, it also creates a news cycle.
Yeah, it creates,
right?
A news cycle just to generate more money and just to keep us occupied fighting over issues that don't matter.
Just in general, though, kind of go back to that question.
Yeah.
Do you think government is the answer, or do you think individuals are the answer?
I believe individuals are the answer. I believe if people educated themselves, unfortunately, like some of these statistics that we've been saying, our education system is floundering extremely fast. A lot of people in this country are unaware of what's happening throughout the world or even our own history. A lot of things are being omitted in books. And I believe if people were more aware of what was happening here, then we would understand what we were being told between Republicans and Democrats, that they're both being false to us, that they're both hiding their own personal agendas, that we would be able to demand a lot more and get a lot more in return.
Just out of curiosity, you know, we have a debt crisis in the United States. We're approaching $15 trillion in primary national debt and about $108 trillion in secondary or unfunded liability debt. You know, pensions, Medicare, Social Security, et cetera. So what would your thoughts be on solving that problem?
I mean, that's a billion-dollar question.
It's a trillion-dollar question.
Yeah, trillion, yeah, trillion, yeah, exactly. I misspoke.
But what's a trillion amongst friends?
Should I use the T? Look, it kind of goes back to what we talked about a little bit about global warming before. We need to be more innovative in our ideas of what we're spending on. Also, we all have to take responsibility of what we've been spending on, what we haven't been spending on. You know, a lot of this debt was inflicted by banks being just greedy, sending out as much money as they can, and also by people being greedy, borrowing as much money as we can.
What about government's role in that?
Oh, government's role is allowing the bank to do that. Of course, they're in the same bed. When I say banks, I also mean government. I'm sorry. I should elaborate. But like the government hasn't done much either. So we all make mistakes, but banks get bailed out and people haven't been bailed out. You know, there should be a fine line, a balance between who's benefiting. You know, and that money we're getting bailed out from is taxpayer money.
Yeah, we're going to talk a little bit more about this subject. But are you familiar with the Community Reinvestment Act, the CRA?
No, I'm not.
Well, the CRA was originally signed into law by Carter, and then it was enhanced by Clinton on two occasions, in 92 and 97, 98. And the Community Reinvestment Act mandated that banks put a portion of their capital and profits back into the local community. And an approved method of doing that was mortgages. At the same time, certain folks in Congress, Barney Frank, Maxine Waters, etc., put through a new set of regulations which govern Freddie Mac and Fannie Mae. You're familiar with them, right?
Yes.
Okay. And Freddie Mac and Fannie Mae, up to that time, had been limited to 5% subprime mortgages. Okay, this new legislation allowed them to go to 50% subprime mortgages. In other words, this was everybody needs a house, whether or not they deserve it, whether or not they can afford it. And therein lies the beginnings of the bubble, which caused this collapse, and right now about a $400 billion problem with Freddie Mac and Fannie Mae, whose executives just got $12 million in bonuses.
Yeah, terrible.
So, you know, what government policy fostered the use of capital in very unsavory ways, and then Wall Street took, you know, the government mandate, and for all I know, they were behind the government mandate.
Exactly.
You know, and then they made these derivatives of these mortgages, sold them in tranches of various credit degrees, like little poison pills around the world. So that is really how the whole mess that we find ourselves in came about. That doesn't mean it wouldn't have come about another way. But I guess my question to you is that don't you think government should get out of fiscal policy?
Look, but you also just mentioned before previously that it might have been the banks that were behind that initial even bill to be passed, you know, because they know they can make money off of it. I think the laws that are being enacted, yes, they have nice names on it, right? Like you said, the Community Reinvestment Act.
Exactly.
You know, and the idea with the 14th Amendment being about, you know, helping the slaves, making people people. And then once again, though, now again gets used to make corporate personhood. You know, like something good is being put in, and then now it's being manipulated by the powers that be to become bad. Or who knows, maybe initially that it was meant to be a little bit like this, and the nice name is just for us to be tricked, you know? Kind of like the revolutionary evil militias that are in Africa, you know, when they kill innocent people, they call themselves the Revolutionary Front. Or the
Liberation Army.
Yeah, exactly. Liberation Army. Let's put a positive name on it.
Yeah, we're gonna liberate you permanently.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. And that's the sad part. So, I mean, to me, this isn't like a big government thing that government shouldn't be involved, because if government wasn't involved either, then banks would just have free reign, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Who would have free reign?
So, you know, boil this thought down for me, because I think it's very interesting. You know, we obviously share a distrust of government.
Yes.
And the folks, most of the folks, there are some exceptions, but unfortunately very few, most of the folks that are in government, and we both feel that they're motivated by their job, you know, by all the perks they can get out of their job, by the power that job manifests. And, of course, the folks who put them in power and keep them in power are motivated by the profit factor. And there's nothing wrong with profit, but, you know, not when it's at somebody else's expense. And we're not talking about when two people negotiate a contract. I mean, you know, that's the way the deal goes. We're talking about when contracts are negotiated behind people's backs that affect their lives. And, you know, the unholy alliance between government and business. So in that case, what would you do to make sure that government can't do that? In other words, that government fulfills its purpose, which is public health, safety, and welfare, and defense. Give me 3 points, with three steps that you would take, concrete steps, to limit the role of government and at the same time decrease the influence of, shall we say, less than savory characters in the business community on that government.
Okay, well, the first thing, and I think the most important thing, is going back to education. Because I think if people were just more aware that these things are happening, you know, understanding what we've been taught, and we were just more cognizant of the fact that, okay, like, we have to be careful. We have to keep an eye out on government and these banks and what's happening in the background. I think that's number one. Because then our votes would have more of an impact by us doing this. Because we can demand and we can exactly see, no, this is what was supposed to happen. And, I mean, why that's not happening nowadays, I mean, it's probably for a multitude of reasons. You know, before in the past, in terms of look at the drug crisis we have in this country, the amount of methamphetamines that's happening in middle America, you know, and then not to mention just the total apathy across the youth in America. Where is that apathy coming from? And one thing me and my students were probably discussing was, okay, well, I remember 20 years ago when I was a child, my mom was always at home helping me with my homework. And nowadays, I mean, you definitely need probably two people at home, two people in the workforce, just to pay off for everything, you know, because of the economic crisis. So now children have less and less guidance, you know, less and less money is being put into the educational system. And when we're having, like, youth that are just apathetic and don't care about what's happening in government, and when we have parents who are just too stressed and working, like, long, long hours just to put food on the table, it's easy to understand why people are not paying attention to what government is doing.
And what about unions? I mean, unions have controlled the economic, the educational system in the United States for decades.
Why do you say that?
Well, because it's true. Because teachers because teachers belong to unions. Unions protect teachers. There's tenure. There's no merit. You know, teachers cannot be fired.
Teachers can be fired. And merit is a different.
Teachers can only be fired if you follow a list. I'll tell you what, if you want, you can Google up any public school system, and you can go and take a look at their policies for hiring and firing, and you'll find that it's about 3 pages of steps, appeals, and nonsense to get a teacher fired in a union workforce. The only teachers that can be fired summarily are teachers in charter schools.
Okay. But the thing is this, regardless for a teacher, the difficulties with merit pay are who's going to want to work in schools that are very underserved in the inner cities. You know, in that sense, when you make it about merit, it makes it a lot more difficult for a teacher. As a teacher, our job is to love, like, our students equally and give as much as we can back. You know, so it's a difficult test. It's almost like giving merit pay to cops. And what happens when you give merit pay to cops as well? I mean, maybe they're going to want to fight crime in certain places rather than other places. You know, and for example, one issue that we have in New York City is you have to get a certain amount of parking tickets. You know, there's a certain amount of tickets and summons that police officers have to give, and that's just not right. You know, if people aren't breaking the law, there's no reason that you should be going out and seeking to see where this is happening, you know, for little instances.
Merit is
a difficult issue, I think. In some respects...
I think merit's pretty easy, right? I mean, you measure it by the success of your student, and
not necessarily
testing
different regions,
but based on how your student is doing in moving through life. In other words, perhaps there's a merit system where teachers get bonuses for every student, and I'm talking about all teachers throughout the student's academic career, where they get bonuses if the student moves on to college, or technical school, or national service, or military service, whatever the criteria might have to be. And all those teachers in the chain of that student's academic career gets a bonus.
Okay, that sounds good. To me, I thought you meant in the sense of, like, passing a certain test at a certain time.
No, tests mean nothing. I mean,
okay.
Yes, we have to make sure that students can read and write, and we have to make sure that students can add 2 + 2, but that's small bananas. You know, the big bananas is what kind of person does this student become? What kind of opportunity does this student create? Does this student create for him or herself? And and where does this student go after, you know, high school? I mean,
yeah,
that's
that
really what
of
the test is.
That reminds me of a good Martin Luther King quote: "The true test of education is intelligence plus character." You know.
Well, you know, judge people by their character, not by the color of their skin.
Mm-hmm.
A famous quote of his. In any event, it's kind of interesting because we just kind of touched on unions, and then we kind of bounced off of that. What's your feeling about unions?
The rank and file, the same thing that I feel about governments and the same thing I feel about these institutions. The initial creation was for good, and I still do believe unions, in a sense, are good. Without them, I mean, obviously the profit structure would collapse a lot of people's rights, workers' rights. Now, the leaders of some of these unions, I'm not sure how much I trust them either and what their agendas are as well. But the basis is, I mean, before unions, there was a lot of unsavory action towards workers, you know, and keeping them down, keeping them oppressed as well. So I believe unions are a necessary function. Now, can they be improved upon? 100% they could be improved upon. You know, I'm definitely not one of these, like, talking heads that's just going to defend everybody to the fullest, you know? I mean, 100% things need to be worked upon. There is definitely some corruption.
What do you think about mandatory dues?
What do you mean by mandatory dues?
Well, for instance, we were talking about the education system. So if you're a teacher in the teachers union, each month your dues are taken out of your paycheck automatically, in fact, by the state in which you work, at public expense, right? The public's paying for that administration. That money flows to the union coffers, and, of course, they use it in the manners that you and I are discussing to promote kind of the welfare of the fat cats.
Well, that's wrong. If that's what the money's being used for, then that's wrong.
Well, of course that's what the money. I mean, they spent $400 million in 2008 in the election cycle. They spent $52 million in for the election in Ohio today. That's exactly what the money's been used for.
I understand, but look, we have to realize it's not just unions. Pharmaceutical companies are spending millions and millions of dollars. Oil and natural gas companies are spending millions and millions of dollars. All the lobbyist groups. So it's not just unions. It's every single organization that there is.
I want to come back to that because that comes back to campaign reform, and I'm really interested in your viewpoint on that. But let me ask you a question. You know, unions have kind of infiltrated the Occupy Wall Street outfits here and there. Are you familiar with Leo Girard? He's the United Steelworkers International president.
Okay.
He's also an advisor to Obama.
No, I don't know his relationship to Obama. I do not know the union workers that have gone to Occupy Wall Street have been the rank and file union workers. And it hasn't been so many of the upper echelon players, but the people that have gone there have been people that are part of the 99% regular working class people that wanted to just see people happier and having more benefits, you know? It's not something, there is no political agenda between some of these presidential candidates, you know? And the idea, like, people that are at Occupy Wall Street, like, let me just say something for your audience. This is not like a cheering camp for Obama. Most of the people there are, in fact, upset at what Obama has done and not fulfilled with his promises. We are equally distrustful of Republicans and Democrats and the governmental system as a whole as what's happening to us and just the quality of life that we've been having.
I want to come back to unions, but just out of curiosity, if you don't mind sharing, did you vote for Obama?
Yes, I did.
Would you vote for him again?
I'm not sure. I have to hear what everybody's saying. You know, I'm hoping that maybe there might be even somebody else that gets involved.
Are you, you're upset, though, about the, you're upset about Wall Street, right? Occupy Wall Street is the name of the movement.
Yeah.
Okay.
No, we're upset about everything. That's just the name of the movement. I mean, money controls everything. No, the love of money is the root of all evil. It's the love of money, not money itself.
Do you know how much Mr. Obama has raised from Wall Street and investment banking type firms in the last 3 months?
I'm sure I know a whole bunch of money, and I know everybody in Congress is in the back pocket as well of all this.
Yeah, $15 million. And do you know how much the combined slate of the Republican candidates have raised from that from those same outfits?
How much?
Seven.
Okay, that's still a lot.
You know what? It happens to be, and we'll talk about this, but it happens to be many millions more than should have been raised. I'm really interested. By the way, on this union thing, you know, there's been...
Can I make one statement, though, about the numbers that you just said?
Yes.
Also, these banks are smart. So they realize, unfortunately, just... And I'm not saying one candidate is better than the other candidate. I just told you I'm still even unsure who I want to vote for. But just the way the numbers are playing out, there are no real authentic great Republican candidates right now. While Obama's just already in office, so it makes it an easier investment to invest $15 million in him and then $7 million across all the Republican candidates. You know,
if there was
a power player in the Republican candidates, I'm sure he would have $15 million as well.
Obama's contributions were 4-1 over Republican. Over contribution to Republican candidates in 2008.
Oh, I'm just saying because there's no great Republican candidates right now. Everybody has a.
What do you think of Goldman Sachs?
Goldman Sachs?
Yeah, we have the same reaction.
Yeah, exactly. Like, what should I think about Goldman Sachs? I mean, come on, what's happening is not right. You know what's like when you're giving people massive bonuses, and you're at the same time laying off 20,000 people, or you're supporting companies that are doing that, that's equally wrong.
And at the same time, expending $700,000 for Mr. Obama's coffers?
It's wrong.
Well, not only is it wrong, but I mean, you're aware that Timothy Geithner, right? He was a high mucky-mucking Goldman.
Yeah.
And you're aware that five other members of this administration were high mucky-mucks and Goldman?
Mm-hmm.
And
in the previous administration as well, sir.
Absolutely. You know what? You and I agree. This is a problem across the board. Okay.
Yeah. Well,
unfortunately, we're saddled with a problem that's in office right now.
Mm-hmm.
And the problem in office is telling us how transparent they are, and decrying millionaires, billionaires. You know, promulgating class warfare rather than bringing people together for a common good. And at the same time, this is the number one administration in history in terms of investment bank investment and investment bank infiltration. I mean, no other administration history has had this kind of warm handshake with the investment banks, which publicly they decry, denounce, and say need to be regulated.
This is a wave that's cresting. And I mean, it started after the Great Depression, and then it increased with Reagan, and then it's increasing now with like the ultimate power with Obama and the world that we live in. Like it's just getting bigger and bigger, and people eventually. That's why I keep going back to education and like what me and you were talking about, Reed. If everybody just talked about this at the dinner table, and if everybody was able to realize, so many people don't have time, but if people could organize some time that they can give to the community and abroad, I think then we'd be able to realize, look, this is all BS, basically.
Well, we agree completely on education. I mean, it's one of the reasons I do this radio show, and I exhort my listeners, as any of them will tell you, to, you know, find out for themselves. Spend 10 minutes a week. Google this, Google that.
Can I recommend one book?
You know?
Can I recommend one book for your audience that
sure.
I love? And A People's History of the United States.
Who's the author?
Howard Zinn. He was a World War II veteran. And he was a bomber pilot, and he came back to Columbia. He was raised in New York, and he understood a lot of what was in the history books was unfairly written. A lot was hidden, basically, from the fact, because it may have been somewhat negative, but it was 100% honest. And so, you know how they say history is written from the perspective of the winners?
Of course.
He wrote history from the perspective of the people, hence A People's History of the United States.
Very good. Thank you for that recommendation. So tell me, three bullet points, quickly, how would you reform, because it really comes down to campaigns, right? I mean, this is kind of an ugly conundrum where the campaign laws favor the big donors. I don't care whether they're on the left or the right, whether they're unions or big business, and that promulgates power. Power is lusted after by those in power. and they do anything to maintain that power using the money from the favors that they've done using your money and my money for their buddies. How would you reform that system? Three bullet points.
Well, campaign finance reform is something a lot of people have been talking about, giving people a floor of money so they can actually compete and run. So people like me and you, well, I don't know how much money you have, Reed, but I mean in the sense of giving the average people an ability to compete. You know, in New York City, if I wanted to compete right now, I'm competing against Mayor Bloomberg, who probably is the fifth richest person in the country, something like that. And if he can spend, he would probably be able to spend, I think the number was he spent $79 on every vote. And so probably me, for the amount of money I make per year and what I'd be able to get in investment, I'd probably be able to spend like 37 cents, you know? And I would still compete, you know? Running for office is something that I may want to do in the future. But the idea is we should be able to give the average everyday person a platform that he should be able to speak from, you know? That he could possibly, even if they can't win the election, they could, I'm sure we have enough people in this country and society that have really good ideas, and we need to get these ideas heard.
What would you think of what would you think of a system which, number one, limited donations by any organization, I don't care what it is, profit, nonprofit, union or corporate, to $5,000 per outfit with safeguards that they couldn't go out and, you know, create in 50 different states, 50 different affiliate outfits.
I think we have that already, and I think they've just found loopholes around it. I think that's what everything has been turned into now. Like, isn't the rule you can't, a single donor can't invest more than $23?
That's a single donor. That's a single donor, okay. But you can invest through PACs, you know, political action committees and those types of groups. And the Supreme Court 2 years ago said, you know, that right, they call it a First Amendment right, that right allows either corporations or unions to invest unlimited amounts through PACs. So I'm talking about a system which eliminates all that stuff. I mean, if you're IBM, you can give $5,000 to a candidate. If you are the AFL-CIO, you can give $5,000 to a candidate. There's no way around it. And individual contributors can do the same. So a max would be $5,000 per candidate, per entity, whether the entity is a person or the entity is a union or the entity is a company.
Yeah, I agree with that. I'm for that.
All right, good. Good, because I think campaign reform is kind of it's the foundation of beginning to fix this system. You know, you have to create an environment in which you've leveled the playing field between candidates. People have to choose based on their ideas, their concepts, hopefully the truths that they're telling you and the promises that they're making, and not on, you know, who has a $1 billion presidential war chest and who has a $400 million presidential war chest. I mean, these numbers are obscene.
Yeah. I mean, $1.5 trillion on two wars. And look, once again, going back to the media, and like, we're given an unfair, we're not allowed to share our views. You know, like the conversation we're having right now, Reed, somebody that's maybe from the right and somebody that's from the left, this is how every conversation should go. You know, there should be no fighting and like anger. Like, we're both part of the same exact country. And the fact is, like, when people say certain things nowadays, like, you know, maybe this wasn't the right action, you know, we're given terms like unpatriotic. Or leftist, or rightist.
Or racist, you know, I mean, there's a million
Socialist, communist.
Right?
Yeah, socialist, communist. I mean, England and France and, like, some of these other countries that we're good friends with, you know, part of the Security Council of the United Nations with, have socialist tendencies. You know, other places, China, which we consider communist, is extremely capitalistic in its economic policies. You know, all these terms that we're using, everybody's involved in. But the fact is, we have to be aware that they're really just being used against the people of this country to just get this emotional response of, like, fear or anger.
What's your view of the Constitution?
The Constitution is right. Anytime I've been having an argument with somebody about Occupy Wall Street and people saying something about it, I just paste the First Amendment on, you know, on Facebook, and I say, okay, look, the First Amendment, the freedom to assemble, you know,
Absolutely. Well, you and I are in complete agreement. I mean, we'll talk about this at the end of the show here in a few minutes, but are you a supporter of the Constitution? Let me put it that way.
Yes. Why wouldn't I be?
Okay.
I mean, that's look, this country, oftentimes I'm called somebody that doesn't like this country, you know, because I'm talking about how the government is wrong, how the banks are wrong, how we shouldn't even gone to these wars, you know? Well, I love this country because the same thing, the ideals of this country were 100% right, you know? Now, sometimes mistakes are made, and people have to be made aware of those mistakes, unfortunately. You know, and I'll take that job upon myself, and I think you've taken that job upon yourself as well. But it doesn't mean we dislike this country. It just means we want to see it for what it is, how government should be. The ideals of government are good. The ideals of business are good. The ideals of the unions are good. Now, how they're being run may not be so good.
I think that's well said. You know, I think we both come to a point of agreement, which is this country should be based on its constitution, literally. And many things which are happening, whether it's in unions or whether it's in government or whether it's in the corporate world, many things that are happening are exactly the opposite of the ideals of the founders. And, you know, it doesn't matter whether you're left or right. You know, you and I may disagree on certain aspects of the approach, but I think the end result, right, is a stronger America based on its constitution, where people have equal voice, they have a say in their government, and the government is not controlled by the elite. And it's the elite on the left, and it's the elite on the right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. So Mother Jones, people should look this up. It's a very good news magazine. And they did, like, these wonderful graphs, and it's called It's the Inequality Stupid on Mother Jones. And it's these 10 graphs that just show the level of inequality in America. And one of the great statistics was this. It said one out of two members of Congress is a millionaire. And then they took the 10 richest members of Congress. They're worth about $5 billion.
Yeah, seven of which are Democrats, three of which are Republicans.
Okay, yeah, at this time when this was made, it was 5 and 5. But yeah, exactly. So it doesn't matter what they are. It's just they're both filthy rich, and all of them voted for the Bush tax cuts. You know, so in essence, like, it's like the people that have money are hoarding their money. You know, and people like us are kind of urged to fight each other, making it a Republican and Democrat issue, when really it's an issue of just what's happening in our society.
Well, you know, if you believe, as we discussed earlier in the show, that it really comes down to individual empowerment, and correct me if I say anything that you don't believe or that's incorrect, but if it comes down to individual empowerment, why do you think higher taxes creates individual empowerment?
No, in certain, I don't know about higher taxes, but I know our taxes used more wisely. You know, all the money that we've spent on the military would have been enough to send everybody to college. You know, sending those people to college, especially, say, people in the inner city, we send some people like that to college. That's where also a lot of people, there's a lot of poverty, a lot of welfare. We'd be saving money by giving people the opportunity to create their own opportunities and their own jobs.
That, but let me give you a couple figures, because I think it will I think it will affect maybe the way you think and perhaps your talking points. Do you know how much the United States has spent protecting its foreign oil resources over the last 30 years?
How much?
$7 trillion. Now, you talk about
$7 trillion?
$7 trillion.
I have to believe it's a little bit more than that.
Well, you know what? No. Whether it's $7 trillion, $10 trillion, or $15 trillion,
yeah.
Think about what would have happened if that money had been invested in making America energy independent.
Exactly.
Right? Our fuel costs would be half. The economy would be rocking and rolling. We'd have another 2 to 3 million people employed, and there would have been a large portion of those funds, whether it's $7 or $10 trillion. I mean, we're talking a lot of money that could have been invested for the benefit of folks for educational purposes.
I know, just sending people to giving people. It's mind-boggling. You know, like one B-52 bomber. You know. Our military budget is larger than the entire world's combined.
Well, on the other hand, you know, let's take the devil's advocate. If you're not safe, you have nothing, right?
Oh, but I'm saying this: if we cut ours in half, we would still have the largest military budget in the world. We have some of the most brilliant military strategists in the world. The idea is, I feel like if we just cut some money out, that doesn't mean we're going to become weaklings. Money is not what makes us a strong country. It's our passion, our drive, our technique, our strategies that make us a very strong country. You know, like, we don't need to rely so much on the money. I mean, just look at baseball. Look at the Yankees. They buy the most and most and most and most, and now they're not winning that much. You know, like,
that's
the idea,
an understatement.
We could spend wisely and be like, okay, like, look, one B-2 bomber is $2 billion. How many kids can we send to school that could then give us energy independence? Like, my students ask me, okay, we're doing all these sanctions against Iran. Why are they not working? And I told them, okay, what would be the ultimate sanction against Iran? What do they make most of their money on? Oil. And so the fact of the matter is this: until we say, no, we're not going to buy your oil, we're not going to hurt their economy.
Well, yes. Actually, there are sanctions on their oil, but that's besides the point. Wait, while we're on that subject, and then I want to move to something else. While we're on that subject, what do you think we ought to do about Iran? What do you think we ought to do about their development of a nuclear weapon?
Look, I'm not sure how close they are to having a nuclear weapon, and this is, like, one of the trickiest situations in the world. One thing that we definitely cannot just do is run in there and just start fighting. They have a very strong military. There's a lot of animosity as to what's been happening in the Arab world. I think one thing that we should do is educate the people of Iran. That's what kind of a benefit that we should do, because there's already been massive protests in Iran that are against their president and their government.
Yeah, and just out of curiosity, what's your opinion about Obama not stepping up and helping them out in 2009?
What, the people?
Yes.
I mean, I'm not sure why, you know, and I'm not sure if he didn't, but I know a lot more can be done. And just simply looking at what happened in the Arab Spring, Egypt, Tunisia, Libya, all these places, well, Libya not so much, there was military intervention, but everywhere there's been these uprisings, and these uprisings were fueled by things like social media, you know, education and communication between the people of these countries. Are you familiar with the country of Bahrain?
No, I'm not.
Gulf?
I mean, I'm partially familiar. I'm not an expert.
Okay, Bahrain is a tiny, tiny country, probably 300,000 people, okay, right in the Persian Gulf, right near Kuwait, Iran, and Saudi Arabia, and in between also the United Arab Emirates. Extremely wealthy because of oil. Now, the people do not have any of that wealth. The people recently saw that on Google Maps, when they saw the actual layout of the country and where all the best land was, they saw all these massive, massive palaces and horse tracks that just lay empty right by the beach, while they're all squirmed into this tiny, tiny parcel of land, and they have nowhere near, they're not getting any of the benefits of all that oil money. Now, they started rising up. Now, a lot of people there started getting attacked. You know, the people of Bahrain and the leaders of Bahrain and the leaders of Syria, they saw what happened in Egypt and Tunisia, and they just said, okay, we're just going to start killing some of these protesters. We're not going to be nice. We're not going to let them protest because eventually they'll win. Now, we didn't do anything about it as a country. Why? Because we also have our largest naval base in that region, in Bahrain, you know? So who we're helping and what we're helping, you know, Mr. Obama and the leaders that run the government and so forth, a lot of this is strategy as well. You know, it's not purely about democratic reform. Otherwise, we'd be helping.
Well, why do you think the Obama administration, on one hand, goes into Libya, and on the other hand, has allowed now more than 3,000 unarmed people to be slaughtered in Syria, and basically,
well,
you know, said nothing. I mean, I think Hillary Clinton said Assad was a reformer. I mean, say what?
Exactly. Well, Libya was more a European intervention than a U.S. intervention. They took hold of that because Europeans were afraid if nothing was fixed in North Africa, there would be a huge migration of their former colonies, of people coming back to say, okay, now you owe us. You know, you were in our region for a whole couple hundred years. Now I think it's your turn to help us out. And I think they went into Libya, not to mention Libya also has massive amounts of oil. You saw what British Petroleum did in Libya in the sense of helping free that Lockerbie bomber in Scotland so they could bring him back to Libya so Libya could give them concessions on oil. There's a lot of people sleeping with each other in bed in terms of corruption and sneaky maneuvers. So,
are you upset or concerned? You know, that portions of the Arab Spring have been hijacked by radicals?
I'm sure to some extent it's possible, but I like to believe that the people that are there have experienced some sort of freedom, you know, experienced this, like, liberating feeling that they were able to accomplish what they wanted to accomplish, and I don't believe that they're just going to give power to somebody else right away, radicalized or not, you know? It's something that's going to have to be done through discussion and understanding, and also, like, I'm not fully aware of to what level the radicalness is in a lot of these countries nowadays, you know? Like,
do you think the Muslim Brotherhood is benign?
I'm not sure if they're benign, but I'm not sure if they're as radical as we've made them out to be, you know?
Our government says they're benign. It's just the opposite.
Okay, yeah, I don't know. So I'm not truly 100% aware on it. You know, I'm sure what other people have been told, like, telling me about it, you know, in that sense, but in terms of what they truly are, who really knows?
What's your viewpoint on Israel?
My viewpoint on Israel, this is the other tricky situation that we're having in the world. Israel is fearing for its statehood, but if they were to just go into Iran and fight, that's also bringing America into fight. You know, inevitably, our countries are linked to an extent, and I'm not sure how beneficial that is to either side, you know, in terms of none of us are totally the most popular people in the world at the current moment. And if we were to just go into war with Iran, like, this is already a very sensitive area in the Middle East. You know, it could spark even, like, I don't want to sound too drastic, but I mean, the possibilities are there of, like, you know, World War III is, like, just so many countries getting involved. There's already been all these revolutions that have been started by the people themselves in these countries because of all the dictatorships, you know?
Do you think Iran would use a nuclear weapon if they got one?
No, they don't have one right now.
No,
so
I said, do you think they would use it if they got one?
I don't think so. I think the nuclear weapon to have is just for the sake of defense. I like to believe that there's no country in the world that would want to destroy the entire world.
So you think Ahmadinejad is just he's just spouting off when he said more than 107 occasions, you know, the first use of a nuclear weapon will be Israel. We're going to wipe them off the face of the earth. What, do you not believe him?
I'm not sure of his full capabilities as president, and I know a lot of people in Iran, like, this is why I was saying we have to keep educating the people of Iran, because a lot of people in Iran don't want this to happen, that their actual citizens don't want this to happen, and I have faith that the citizens of the country may be able to prevent this, you know, in the sense of, and we know whether they're going to be able to make nuclear weapons or not, you know, and that's still multiple years away from even possibly happening, and anything could happen in multiple
places. Actually, the new IAEC report says that they're months away.
Months away now?
Months away. Months away.
I'm going to have to check this out, because last time I checked, it was a couple years.
Came out yesterday.
Okay, well, also came out yesterday, yeah, the fact that Israel wants to attack Iran. So, I mean, look, it's such a tricky situation. What is your thoughts on this? What would you suggest?
My thoughts are that Iran must be prevented from obtaining a nuclear device through any means possible. And because Mr. Bush and now Mr. Obama have squandered countless opportunities to help the people of Iran rise up and overthrow that government, and at the same time have squandered numerous opportunities to use economic and other sanctions to bring Iran to its knees and abandon the nuclear program, now we're faced with two choices. They either get a bomb, which they will use, I mean, unless you think that they're just lying in all these bully pulpits, or we stop them from getting a bomb. It's just that simple. And I think a nuclear Iran would precipitate exactly what your greatest fear is, which is World War III.
I think inevitably, though, we're now in a position where we're screwed either way, because just if we had a bomb,
you know what? I think that's well said.
if we bomb their nuclear facility, there's no doubt that they're just gonna. They have other missiles, you know. They have other weapons, and they have a very strong military in that sense. And to go in there and just to bomb it would ignite a war, regardless. You know,
so yeah, far better a conventional conflict than a nuclear conflict.
Yeah, well. I don't know. I'd like to believe, though, if we can prevent the nuclear weapon from coming forth and just building ties, like, there has to be another way than just the idea of fighting, you know? And that has to be done. Because regardless, a nuclear weapon is more just like a penis-showing contest. Look, we have one, you have one. I know that he said that he's used it, but he also knows that if he uses it, Israel has over 50 nuclear weapons, then they would be able to destroy Iran.
The mentality of the ruling caste in Iran is radical Islam, right? They believe in the coming of the 12th Imam, and the 12th Imam can only come when blood runs red on the earth.
Look, I'm not totally aware of it, but I know, though, that the people of Iran have been rising up and do not necessarily like the leaders of Iran.
I agree with you 100%, but, you know,
if these cases
this administration has done nothing to assist them. I mean, this administration has thought that, you know, they're going to get along with these people, and they can't get along with these people. I mean, sometimes there are people that you just can't get along with. So instead of supporting the people of Iran in their uprising in 2009, you know, we ignored them. I mean, I think it's a travesty. And we go into Libya and bomb, assist the Europeans in taking out Gaddafi, yet we do nothing in Syria. I mean, I scratch my head.
Or Bahrain, yeah.
Or Bahrain, it doesn't matter. I mean, you know, if you have a policy for helping the oppressed and hopefully assisting people in achieving, you know, democracy and individual empowerment, which you and I agree on, then let's follow through on it. I mean, you know, you can't pick and choose winners for political or business purposes.
Exactly. I'm in 100% agreement.
So we're going to be wrapping up the show soon, but I want to ask you some tough questions about Occupy Wall Street. I mean, depending upon which news organization you watch, but, you know, some of the images that are coming out, I mean, even on MSNBC, which I think supports you folks 100%, some of the images that are coming out, I mean, turn off the average American, let's face it. And the riots in Oakland really pissed off a lot of people. You know, the unrest and the violence in Denver has pissed off Colorado. So you're now at a point where 43%, this was a Gallup poll yesterday, 43% of Americans, you know, hold the Occupy Wall Street movement in disdain, and 33% or 34% think it's okay, and the others say, you know, they don't want to be bothered. There's also been documented cases of, you know, Acorn being involved in paying folks to go down and be part of the protest. The same with unions.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, you know, on Angie's list there were ads. They were pulled. But on Angie's list there were ads saying, you know, you want to make $300 to $600 a week, we have a job for you. And the job was to carry signs.
Okay, yeah, that's definitely not happening in Zuccotti Park. A couple of your statements that you've made already. One thing is also equally, I could say, people have been homeless folk and people coming out of prison have been told to come to the parks to create a disservice, to create a area of like animosity between the people and conflict. There are rumors that has been occurring as well. You know, taking homeless people from Brooklyn and bringing them to Manhattan, dropping them off the park, and saying, "Okay, these people are going to take care of you." That's creating a lot of the negative images that are coming out onto TV. Also, like I have to say, all these news organizations that we're talking about and the images that are coming are all major, major, major corporations that are being attacked by Occupy Wall Street. You know, this is a movement where we're not making any friends because we're calling everybody out on their BS.
Well, just what's your thoughts and what's the thoughts of the folks there in New York at Zuccotti Park on what happened in Oakland? At the port.
Okay, well, what happened in Oakland? First, let's make the first statement. Scott Olson, a veteran of the Iraq War who served two tours in Iraq, he got shot in the head with a tear gas canister, and he may have brain damage. You know, he was a member of the Iraqi Veterans Against the War. One out of three Iraqi veterans has come out.
Yeah, but that's not my question. What is your opinion of 3,000 to 4,000 people storming the port of Long Beach disrupting that port, which disrupts many, many people across the United States and around the world in terms of their occupation, their livelihoods, et cetera. What's your opinion of that?
Well, look, in terms of the civil disobedience, that's fine. In terms of breaking property and everyday other people's property, that's wrong. Also, one thing that didn't come out, though, a lot of people also then came back to clean that up. Whenever you're trying to change the status quo, which is what we're trying to do, you're going to get a lot of radical people. And in that sense, yeah, those people are on the fringes. They're not the actual movement.
And what are you guys doing to clean it up? I mean,
people came out in Oakland and swept up and cleaned up.
No. What are you doing to clean out the radical elements in your group?
See, that we're working on, because also we want to be an autonomous organization. You know, we don't want to kind of try and inhibit people and saying, you can't do this, you can't do it. Like, we do our best to say, oh, when it comes to illegal activities, we say, yeah, don't do this, don't do that, you know? But in terms of when we're saying, no, you can't be involved in this and you can't be involved in that, that's not very democratic. And so in that sense, we're learning. You know, we're a very young movement. It's 5-6 weeks old. But already we've become the biggest news story in the world. You know, and this is like one of the first movements in America that's like a big protesting movement that's not politically affiliated in a very, very long time.
How many people are down there on the average at Zuccotti Park?
Could you say that again? I'm sorry.
How many folks are down there on the average at Zuccotti Park?
Oh, there's always like a few thousand people there.
Mm-hmm.
Always.
So
and I'm talking about then also people coming from around the world, checking us out, tourists. People that are just coming from work.
Yeah, no, I'm talking about the folks that are, you know, involved in the movement. So it's a few thousand?
About 1,000, always at that moment there, but not everybody could be there all the time. You know, one thing that's kind of given is saying that everybody there is out of jobs. Like, I have a job and I'm there Tuesdays, Thursdays.
No, that's not my viewpoint at all. I guess what I'm trying to bring out is that if there's a few thousand people down there consistently, you know, that's in a city of 8 million people. I mean, that's not a large percentage.
I would say about 20,000 people then are throughout the week in that sense.
And I mean, that's still not a large percentage.
No, it's not that large. But you know what Margaret Mead said, anybody that wants to change the world, it's a small group of dedicated individuals that'll be able to change the world.
Right. Well, you know, one of the things which, and this is my opinion, I mean, if you guys want to have credibility, you need to make sure the unions don't have their tentacles around you,
mm-hmm.
which they do. I mean, all you got to do is listen to their hotshots. You know, we spoke about the United Steelworkers International President Leo Girard, right,
mm-hmm.
who's an advisor to Obama, and he called, this is a week ago Monday, he called for more militancy in the Occupy movements across the United States. And, of course, a few days later, you had the riots in Long Beach, which was not a small group. That was 3,000 to 4,000 people that participated
yes.
in that, you know, shall we say, activity which got you no goodwill.
I'll tell you this. That might have been a coincidence, because there's nobody in the unions. There's no one individual person that can say, let's do this. It's the people have to consent to doing something, you know? And so these unions, what a lot of these unions are saying, I think they want to join us for our popularity, but the people aren't going to let them. Or at least I'm not going to let them, you
Good.
Know, after listening to you and so forth. I mean, it's a popular movement, so they want to just now join the in crowd.
Absolutely. I think a lot of people will try and clam onto your coattails
yes.
to get PR and to further, you know, here's the irony. They're going to clam onto your coattails to further their own ends, which are the very ends that upset you.
Yeah, I agree. One of the founders of the Tea Party gave us advice. You know, he agrees with our movement. And he basically said, look, our movement was amazing. And then we kind of got suckered into this, like, popularity game, and we let all these politicians come in, and they basically just hijacked the movement and took it away from what the original premise of the movement was. You know, and I mean, we took that to heart, you know. A lot of people, part of this movement, 60% of the people in this movement, this is their first time ever being actively involved in any sort of movement. Also, me and, like, a lot of people, we probably considered ourselves on the left side. I used to be the type of person that would just want to have an argument with, like, a Republican, you know? And now I'm realizing, like, who was I back then, you know? Like, why was I just having these simple arguments with the people next to me when I realized, like, we were just pitted against each other? But in reality, we're all working towards some sort of common change, you know? Like, the Tea Party, I may have used to look at it as something kind of foolish. You know, I would see, oh, people with guns at a field. And now I'm like, okay, well, maybe that's all they're just showing in the media. And meanwhile, there might have been a whole lot more other mainstream regular folk that were there, you know?
I think that's a very well-reasoned and very accurate approach. Just out of curiosity, do you know how you guys got to use Zuccotti Park?
It was by accident, actually.
You think?
Well, I think so, yeah. The idea was that went there.
Do you know who...
What was your story?
Do you know who Bayfield Office Properties is?
Yeah, Brookfield Office Properties.
Yeah, Brookfield.
The ones that run the park.
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm. And then they're owned by an outfit called Bayfield, and then they're owned by an outfit called Blackstone, which is a Canadian company.
Okay.
Did you know that just prior to you folks requesting use of Zuccotti Park, $138.5 million was given from the stimulus program as a loan guarantee to the Canadian company, which is the owner of Bayfield, which owns Zuccotti Park?
Okay. Well, I know that there was no intention to occupy Zuccotti Park. The intention was to actually occupy the streets of Wall Street, like the actual streets of Wall Street. Now, it became known to the NYPD and the government that we wanted to do that, and so therefore they blocked off all the streets to Wall Street. And so in the process of searching around for a place, we actually just ended up at Zuccotti Park, which is very close to Wall Street.
Yeah, I understand, but here's my point. The American taxpayer is funding the rent for Zuccotti Park. And
well,
that's
not really
rent. You know what? That's not your fault.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I think that perhaps a lot of the folks that are camped out in Zuccotti Park don't know what's happened here behind the scenes. But I'm bringing it up because, first of all, I think this conversation has been great. You know, you and
mm-hmm.
I agree on many points. We may approach them from different angles.
Yep.
But, you know, based on constitutional concepts, empowerment of the individual, and disrupting this corrupt flow of power and money, which is what this political system has become.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you and I may look at it from different angles as to what we want the final end result to be or how the steps that we need to do to change this and make this the America that George Washington, Thomas Jefferson, and John Adams envisioned. But you do need to be cognizant of what's happening behind the scenes for your movement because, you know, there's manipulation going on that you don't even know about. You know, there's people who are trying to hijack your movement, which you tell me, you know, is something that you really abhor. And they're doing it through the most insidious of channels. I'm giving you this example of
mm-hmm.
the American taxpayer basically renting Zuccotti Park for you for $138 million. Now, who knows what the motives were on that? Maybe it was to keep you out of Wall Street. Maybe it was to get some tentacles into you to try and control what you do. I don't know what the motives were. But, you know, these are facts. I mean, this has happened. So that whole process of education is something that I think you folks need to kind of stay abreast of, you know, in terms of your movement. I mean, who is trying to control it and for what reasons and in what ways? And I think the more, you know, it's like any type of education, which you and I agree on, the more you know about that, you know, the more effective you will be in combating, number one, it happening, and number two, its effects when it does happen.
Mm-hmm. No, you're 100% correct.
All right. Well,
we also have to keep educating ourselves, you know, consistently and just evolving.
Well, listen, you have a Facebook page.
Yes, I have a Facebook page. Facebook.com/AnoopDesai. That's A-N-U-P. Last name Desai. D like in dog. E-S-A-I. And if anyone out there, any of your listeners, if they ever want to just talk to me personally and send me a message, they're more than welcome to.
Well, Anoop, let me tell you, it's been a pleasure. I'm actually both surprised and pleased at how the conversation went. I thought we would have disagreements on more items than we did. And I will look forward, you know, I would like to talk to you again, let's say in a month or 6 weeks, as your,
yeah, that'd be fantastic.
As your movement kind of evolves, and as you, because I think you're the kind of guy, I've given you a couple of tidbits here, and I think
okay.
you'll probably research them, and I think it would be really good if you did, you know, particularly this kind of, there's a lot of words I could use. Why don't we say this attempt to infiltrate your movement, either make it look good, make it look bad, or twist it to somebody else's purposes? Because,
okay.
you know, the ideas that you espouse, if these are truly the ideas that the majority of Occupy Wall Streeters espouse, I think folks can get behind.
Mm-hmm.
On the other hand, you know, if what people are seeing on the screen, if what people are talking about, if it's riots in Long Beach, you know, violence in Denver, or like yesterday, a number of Washington, D.C. Occupy folks tried to storm the, you know, Center for American, what is the name of it, the Center for American Values during one of their conferences, you know, that is not good. And if agitators are doing that to discredit your movement, you know, you need to get rid of those people.
Mm-hmm. Can I tell you one really good story?
This would be the same as a Tea Party having a rally and agitators on purpose sending a few people in there, you know, with pictures of black people hanging from ropes,
exactly.
right? I mean, they're doing it. The whole thing is to discredit a movement.
Exactly. Can I tell you one really good story that did happen?
Yes, absolutely.
At Occupy Nashville, right outside Vanderbilt University, the Republican, the Young Republicans organization of Vanderbilt University came out, and they wanted to have a counter-protest to Occupy Wall Street. And so, like, a contingent of, like, 100, 200 of them strong went to the Occupy Park, and basically they tried to not disrupt, but they tried to go to the General Assembly to speak. And what eventually happened was the General Assembly let them speak, and then they all broke down into smaller groups of about 10 people, and they all had these conversations with each other. And eventually what came out of it was kind of like a conversation that me and you just had, where the Young Republican group were like, wow, we're surprised that they were so welcoming. The Occupy Wall Street group was like, well, we're surprised that they were so, like, kind, you know? And basically, like, they realized, you know what, we're not that far apart from each other. You know, and like, and friendships developed. And to me, that's a beautiful story that's not that promoted.
Well, of course, but it's not promoted. It doesn't serve people's ends, right?
Yeah,
right.
Exactly.
Listen, this has been terrific. I really appreciate
mm-hmm.
it. This is Reed Lance Rosenthal on the right side with Anup Desai, and he is a press spokesman and one of the organizers of Occupy Wall Street in Zuccotti Park. This has been an extremely interesting conversation. I look forward to resuming it with you in the next 4 to 6 weeks.
Mm-hmm. Fantastic. Thank you so much. And once again, if your audience can read it, A People's History of the United States, one of my favorite books. And let's all get united and make a great change.
Great tip, Anup. Have a great day.
All the best. Thank you. Take
Bye
care.
Now.
For more information about Reed and his work, please click on the globe in front of you on the webtalkradio.net page. You can also click on his book, Land for Love and Money, and his new best-selling historical western series, Threads West, An American Saga. Watch for the second volume of the saga, Maps of Fate, coming soon. And, of course, if you've missed any shows, just click on Show Archives to catch up. We look forward to seeing you here again next week for another episode of Reed L. Rosenthal on the Right Side.